Chapter 10. Vianne closed her eyes and thought, "Hurry home, Antoine." It was all she allowed herself, just that one small plea. How could she handle all of this? War, and Captain Beck, and Isabel, alone. She wanted to daydream, pretend that her world was upright instead of fallen on its side, that the closed guest room door meant nothing, that Sophie had slept with Vianne last night because they'd fallen asleep reading, that Antoine was outside on this dewy dawn morning, chopping wood for a winter that was still months away. Soon he would come in and say,
"Well, I am off to a day of delivering mail."
Perhaps he would tell her of his latest postmark, a letter in from Africa or America, and he would spin her a romantically imagined tale to go along with it. Instead, she returned her knitting to the basket by the divan, put on her boots, and went outside to chop wood. It would be autumn again in no time, and then winter, and the devastation of her garden by the refugees had reminded her how perilously balanced her survival was. She lifted the axe and brought it down, hard. Grasp. Raise. Steady. Chop. Every chop reverberated up her arms and lodged painfully in the muscles of her shoulders. Sweat squeezed from her pores, dampened her hair.
"Allow me, please, to do this for you."
She froze, the axe in mid-air. Beck stood nearby, dressed in his breeches and boots, with only a thin white t-shirt covering his chest. His pale cheeks were reddened from a morning shave, and his blonde hair was wet. Droplets fell onto his t-shirt, making a pattern of small gray sunbursts. She felt acutely uncomfortable in her robe and work boots, with her hair pinned in curls. She lowered the axe.
"There are some things a man does around the house. You are much too fragile to chop wood."
"I can do it."
"Of course you can, but why should you? Go, madame. See to your daughter. I can do this small thing for you. Otherwise my mother will beat me with a switch."
She meant to move, but somehow she didn't. And then he was there, pulling the axe gently out of her hand. She held on instinctively for a moment. Their gazes met, held. She released her hold and stepped back so quickly she stumbled. He caught her by the wrist, steadied her. Mumbling a thank you, she turned and walked away from him, keeping her spine as straight as she could. It took all of her limited courage not to speed up. Even so, by the time she reached the door, she felt as if she'd run from Paris. She kicked free of the oversized gardening boots, saw them hit the house with a thunk and fall in a heap. The last thing she wanted was kindness from this man who had invaded her home. She slammed the door shut behind her and went to the kitchen, where she lit the stove and put a pot of water on to boil. Then she went to the bottom of the stairs and called her daughter down for breakfast. She had to call two more times, and then threaten, before Sophie came trudging down the stairs, her hair a mess, the look in her eyes sullen. She was wearing her sailor dress, again. In the 10 months Antoine had been gone, she'd outgrown it, but she refused to stop wearing it.
"I'm up,"
she said, shuffling to the table, taking her seat. Vianne placed a bowl of cornmeal mush in front of her daughter. She had splurged this morning and added a tablespoon of preserved peaches on top.
"Maman, can't you hear that? There's someone knocking at the door."
Vianne shook her head. All she'd heard was the thunk, thunk, thunk of the axe and went to the door, opening it. Rachel stood there, with the baby in her arms and Sarah tucked in close to her side.
"You are teaching today with your hair pinned?"
"Oh!"
Vianne felt like a fool. What was wrong with her? Today was the last day of school before the summer break.
"Let's go, Sophie. We are late."
She rushed back inside and cleared the table. Sophie had licked her plate clean, so Vianne laid it in the copper sink to wash later. She covered the leftover pot of mush and put the preserved peaches away. Then she ran upstairs to get ready. In no time, she had removed her hairpins and combed her hair into smooth waves. She grabbed her hat, gloves, and handbag and left the house to find Rachel and the children waiting in the orchard. Captain Beck was there too, standing by the shed. His white t-shirt was soaked in places and clung to his chest, revealing the whorls of hair beneath. He had the axe slung casually against one shoulder.
"Ah, greetings," he said.
Vian could feel Rachel's scrutiny. Beck lowered the axe.
"This is a friend of yours, madame?"
"Rachel," Vian said tightly. "My neighbor. This is Herr Captain Beck. He is the one billeting with us."
"Greetings,"
Beck said again, nodding politely. Vian put a hand on Sophie's back and gave her daughter a little shove, and they were off, trudging through the tall grass of the orchard and out onto the dusty road.
"He's handsome,"
Rachel said as they came to the airfield, which was abuzz with activity behind the coils of barbed wire.
"You didn't tell me that."
"Is he?"
"I'm pretty sure you know he is, so your question is interesting. What's he like?"
"German."
"The soldiers billeted with Claire Moreau look like sausages with legs. I hear they drink enough wine to kill a judge and snore like rooting hogs. You're lucky, I guess."
"You're the lucky one, Rachel. No one has moved into your house."
"Poverty has its reward at last."
She linked her arm through Vian's.
"Don't look so stricken, Vian. I hear they have orders to be correct."
Vian looked at her best friend.
"Last week, Isabel chopped off her hair in front of the captain and said beauty must be verboten."
Rachel couldn't stifle her smile completely.
"Oh."
"It's hardly funny. She could get us killed with her temper."
Rachel's smile faded.
"Can you talk to her?"
"Oh, I can talk. When has she ever listened to anyone?"
"You are hurting me,"
Isabel said. The man yanked her away from the wall and dragged her down the street, moving so fast she had to run along beside him. She bumped into the stone alley wall with every step. When she tripped on a cobblestone and almost fell, he tightened his hold and held her upright.
"Think, Isabel."
He wasn't in uniform, so he must be Gestapo. That was bad. And he'd seen her defacing the poster. Did it count as an act of sabotage or espionage or resistance to the German occupation? It wasn't like blowing up a bridge or selling secrets to Britain.
"I was making art. It was going to be a vase full of flowers. Not a V for victory, a vase."
No resistance, just a silly girl drawing on the only paper she could find. "I have never even heard of General de Gaulle." And what if they didn't believe her? The man stopped in front of an oak door with a black lion's head knocker at its center. He rapped 4 times on the door.
"Where are you taking me?"
Was this a back door to the Gestapo headquarters? There were terrible rumors about these Gestapo interrogators. Supposedly they were ruthless and sadistic. But no one knew for sure. The door opened slowly, revealing an old man in a beret. A hand-rolled cigarette hung from his fleshy, liver-spotted lips. He saw Isabel and frowned.
"Open up!"
The man beside Isabel growled, and the old man stepped aside. Isabel was pulled into a room full of smoke. Her eyes stung as she looked around. It was an abandoned novelty store that had once sold bonnets and notions and sewing supplies. In the smoky light, she saw empty display cases that had been shoved up against the walls. Empty metal hat racks were piled in the corner. The window out front had been bricked up, and the back door that faced Rue La Grande was padlocked from the inside. There were 4 men in the room. A tall, graying man, dressed in rags, standing in the corner. A boy seated beside the old man who had opened the door, and a handsome young man in a tattered sweater and worn pants with scuffed boots who sat at a cafe table.
"Who is this, Didier?"
asked the old man who had opened the door. Isabel got the first good look at her captor. He was big and brawny, with the puffed-up look of a circus strongman and a heavily jowled, oversized face. She stood as tall as possible, with her shoulders pressed back and her chin lifted. She knew she looked ridiculously young in her plaid skirt and fitted blouse, but she refused to give them the satisfaction of knowing she was afraid.
"I found her chalking V's on the German posters," said the swarthy man who'd caught her, Didier.
Isabel fisted her right hand, trying to rub the orange chalk away without them noticing.
"Have you nothing to say?"
said the old man standing in the corner. He was the boss, obviously.
"I have no chalk."
"I saw her doing it."
Isabel took a chance.
"You're not German," she said to the strong man. "You're French. I'd bet money on it. And you," she said to the old man, "you're the pork butcher."
The boy she dismissed altogether, but to the handsome young man in the tattered clothes she said,
"You look hungry, and I think you're wearing your brother's clothes or something you found hanging on a line somewhere. Communist."
He grinned at her, and it changed his whole demeanor. But it was the man in the corner she cared about, the one in charge. She took a step toward him.
"You could be Aryan. Maybe you're forcing the others to be here."
"I've known him all my life, mademoiselle," the pork butcher said. "I fought beside his father, and yours, at Somme. You're Isabel Rossignol, oui?"
She didn't answer. Was it a trap?
"No answer," said the Bolshevik.
He rose from his seat, came toward her.
"Good for you. Why were you chalking a V on the poster?"
Again, Isabel remained silent.
"I am Henri Navarre," he said, close enough now to touch her. "We are not Germans, nor do we work with them, mademoiselle."
He gave her a meaningful look.
"Not all of us are passive. Now why were you marking up their posters?"
"It was all I could think of," she said.
"Meaning?"
She exhaled evenly.
"I heard de Gaulle's speech on the radio."
Henri turned to the back of the room, sent a glance to the old man. She watched the two men have an entire conversation around her without speaking a word. At the end of it, she knew who the boss was, the handsome communist, Henri. At last Henri said, turning to her again,
"If you could do something more, would you?"
"What do you mean?"
she asked.
"There is a man in Paris. A group, actually, from the Musée de l'Homme,"
the burly man corrected him. Henri held up a hand.
"We don't say more than we must, Didier. Anyway, there is a man, a printer, risking his life to make tracts that we can distribute. Maybe if we can get the French to wake up to what is happening, we have a chance."
Henri reached into a leather bag that hung on his chair and pulled out a sheaf of papers. A headline jumped out at her. "Vive le Général de Gaulle." The text was an open letter to Maréchal Pétain that expressed criticism of the surrender. At the end it read, "Nous sommes pour le Général de Gaulle." We support General de Gaulle.
"Well?"
Henri said quietly. And in that single word, Isabel heard the call to arms she'd been waiting for.
"Will you distribute them?"
"Me?"
"We are communists and radicals," Henri said. "They are already watching us. You are a girl, and a pretty one at that. No one would suspect you."
Isabel didn't hesitate.
"I'll do it."
The men started to thank her. Henri silenced them.
"The printer is risking his life by writing these tracts, and someone is risking his or her life by typing them. We are risking our lives by bringing them here. But you, Isabel, you are the one who will be caught distributing them, if you are caught. Make no mistake, this is not chalking a V on a poster. This is punishable by death."
"I won't get caught," she said.
Henri smiled at that.
"How old are you?"
"Almost 19.
"Ah," he said. And how can one so young hide this from her family?
My family is not the problem, Isabel said. They pay no attention to me. But there's a German soldier billeted at my house, and I would have to break curfew.
It will not be easy. I understand if you are afraid. Henri began to turn away. Isabel snatched the papers back from him.
I said I'd do it.
Isabel was elated. For the first time since the armistice, she wasn't completely alone in her need to do something for France. The men told her about dozens of groups like theirs throughout the country, mounting a resistance to follow de Gaulle. The more they talked, the more excited she became at the prospect of joining them. Oh, she knew she should be afraid, they told her often enough. But it was ridiculous, the Germans threatening death for handing out a few pieces of paper. She could talk her way out of it if she were caught. She was sure of it. Not that she would get caught. How many times had she sneaked out of a locked school or boarded a train without a ticket or talked her way out of trouble? Her beauty had always made it easy for her to break rules without reprisal.
When we have more, how will we contact you? Henri asked as he opened the door to let her leave.
She glanced down the street.
The apartment above Madame Lafoy's hat shop. Is it still vacant?
Henri nodded.
Open the curtains when you have papers. I'll come by as soon as I can.
Knock four times. If we don't answer, walk away, he said.
After a pause, he added,
Be careful, Isabel.
He shut the door between them. Alone again, she looked down at her basket. Settled under a red and white checked linen cloth were the tracts. On top lay the butcher paper-wrapped ham hocks. It wasn't much of a camouflage. She would need to figure out something better. She walked down the alley and turned onto a busy street. The sky was darkening. She'd been with the men all day. The shops were closing up. The only people milling about were German soldiers and the few women who'd chosen to keep them company. The cafe tables out on the street were full of uniformed men, eating the best food, drinking the best wines. It took every ounce of nerve she had to walk slowly. The minute she was out of town, she started to run. As she neared the airfield, she was sweating and out of breath, but she didn't slow. She ran all the way into her yard. With the gate clattering shut behind her, she bent forward, gasping hard, holding the stitch in her side, trying to catch her breath.
Mademoiselle Rossignol, are you unwell?
Isabel snapped upright. Captain Beck appeared beside her. Had he been there before her?
Captain, she said, working hard to still the racing of her heart. A convoy went past. I rushed to get out of their way.
A convoy? I didn't see that.
It was a while back, and I am silly sometimes. I lost track of time talking to a friend and, well...
She gave him her prettiest smile and patted her butchered hair as if it mattered to her that she looked nice for him.
How were the queues today?
Interminable.
Please, allow me to carry your basket inside.
She looked down at her basket, saw the tiniest white paper corner visible under the linen cloth.
No,
I insist. We are gentlemen, you know.
His long, well-manicured fingers closed around the willow handle. As he turned toward the house, she remained at his side.
I saw a large group gathering at the town hall this afternoon. What are the Vichy police doing here?
Ah, nothing to concern you.
He waited at the front door for her to open it. She fumbled nervously with the center-mounted knob, turned it, and opened the door. Although he had every right to go in at will, he waited to be invited in, as if he were a guest.
Isabel, is that you? Where have you been?
Vianne rose from the divan.
The queues were awful today.
Sophie popped up from the floor by the fireplace, where she'd been playing with Bébé.
What did you get today?
Ham hocks,
Isabel said, glancing worriedly at the basket in Beck's hand.
That's all?
Vianne said sharply.
What about the cooking oil?
Sophie sank back to the rug on the floor, clearly disappointed.
I will put the hawks in the pantry, Isabel said, reaching for the basket.
Please, allow me, Beck said.
He was staring at Isabel, watching her closely, or maybe it only felt like that.
Vianne lit a candle and handed it to Isabel. Don't waste it. Hurry.
Beck was very gallant as he walked through the shadowy kitchen and opened the door to the cellar. Isabel went down first, lighting the way. The wooden steps creaked beneath her feet until she stepped down onto the hard-packed dirt floor and into the subterranean chill. The wooden shelves seemed to close in around them as Beck came up beside her. The candle flame sent light gambolling in front of them. She tried to still the trembling in her hand as she reached for the paper-wrapped ham hocks. She placed them on the shelf beside their dwindling supplies.
Bring up 3 potatoes and a turnip, Vianne called down.
Isabel jumped a little at the sound.
You seem nervous, Beck said. Is that the right word, mademoiselle?
The candle sputtered between them.
There were lots of dogs in town today.
The Gestapo. They love their shepherds. There is no reason for this to concern you.
I am afraid of big dogs. I was bitten once as a child.
Beck gave her a smile that was stretched out of shape by the light.
Don't look at the basket.
But it was too late. She saw a little more of the hidden papers sticking out. She forced a smile.
You know us girls, scared of everything.
That is not how I would describe you, mademoiselle.
She reached carefully for the basket and tugged it from his grasp. Without breaking eye contact, she set the basket on the shelf, beyond the candle's light. When it was there, in the dark, she finally released her breath. They stared at each other in uncomfortable silence. Beck nodded.
And now I must away. I have only come here to pick up some papers for a meeting tonight.
He turned back to the steps and began climbing them. Isabel followed the captain up the narrow stairs. When she emerged into the kitchen, Vianne was standing there with her arms crossed, frowning.
Where are the potatoes and a turnip? Vianne asked. I forgot.
Vianne sighed.
Go, she said. Get them.
Isabel turned and went back into the cellar. After she'd gathered up the potatoes and turnip, she went to the basket, lifted the candle to expose the basket to light. There it was, the tiny white triangle of paper peeking out. She quickly withdrew the papers from the basket and shoved them into her panty girdle. Feeling the papers against her skin, she went upstairs, smiling. At supper, Isabel sat with her sister and niece, eating watery soup and day-old bread, trying to think of something to say, but nothing came to her. Sophie, who seemed not to notice, rambled on, telling one story after another. Isabel tapped her foot nervously, listening for the sound of a motorcycle approaching the house, for the clatter of German jackboots on the walkway out front, for a sharp, impersonal knock at the door. Her gaze kept cutting to the kitchen and the cellar door.
You're acting very strangely tonight, Vianne said.
Isabel ignored her sister's observation. When the meal was finally over, Isabel popped out of her seat and said,
I'll do the dishes, V. Why don't you and Sophie finish your game of checkers?
You'll do the dishes?
Vianne said, giving Isabel a suspicious look.
Come on, I've offered before, Isabel said.
Not in my memory.
Isabel gathered the empty soup bowls and utensils. She had offered, only to keep busy, to do something with her hands. Afterward, Isabel could find nothing to do. The night dragged on. Vianne and Sophie and Isabel played Belote, but Isabel couldn't concentrate, she was so nervous and excited. She made some lame excuse and quit the game early, pretending to be tired. In her upstairs bedroom, she lay atop the blankets, fully dressed, waiting. It was past midnight when she heard Beck return. She heard him enter the yard, then she smelled the smoke from his cigarette drift up. Later, he came into the house, clomping around in his boots,
but by 1 o'clock, everything was quiet again. Still she waited. At 4 a.m., she got out of bed and dressed in a heavy worsted knit black sweater and plaid tweed skirt. She ripped a seam open in her summer weight coat and slid the papers inside. Then she put the coat on, tying the belt at her waist. She slipped the ration cards in her front pocket. On the way downstairs, she winced at every creak of sound. It seemed to take forever to get to the front door, more than forever, but finally she was there, opening it quietly, closing it behind her. The early morning was cold and black. Somewhere a bird called out, his slumber probably disturbed by the opening of the door. She breathed in the scent of roses and was overcome by how ordinary it seemed in this moment. From here, there would be no turning back. She walked to the still broken gate, glancing back often at the blacked-out house, expecting Beck to be there, arms crossed, booted feet in a warrior's stance, watching her. But she was alone. Her first stop was Rachel's house. There were almost no mail deliveries these days, but women like Rachel, whose men were gone, checked their letterboxes each day, hoping against hope that the mail would bring them news. Isabel reached inside her coat, felt for the slit in the silk lining, and pulled out a single piece of paper. In one movement, she opened the letterbox and slid the paper inside and quietly shut the lid. Out on the road again, she looked around and saw no one. She had done it! Her second stop was Old Man Rivet's farm. He was a communist through and through, a man of the revolution, and he'd lost a son at the front. By the time she gave away her last tract, she felt invincible. It was just past dawn. Pale sunlight gilded the limestone buildings in town. She was the first woman to queue up outside the shop this morning, and because of that, she got her full ration of butter, 150 grams for the month, 2/3 of a cup, a treasure. Chapter 11. Every day that long hot summer, Vianne woke to a list of chores. She, along with Sophie and Isabel, replanted and expanded the garden and converted a pair of old bookcases into rabbit hutches. She used chicken wire to enclose the pergola. Now the most romantic place on the property stank of manure they collected for their garden. She took in wash from the farmer down the road, Old Man Rivet, in exchange for feed. The only time she really relaxed and felt like herself was on Sunday mornings when she took Sophie to church. Isabel refused to attend Mass, and then had coffee with Rachel, sitting in the shade of her backyard, just two best friends talking, laughing, joking. Sometimes Isabel joined them, but she was more likely to play with the children than talk with the women, which was fine with Vianne. Her chores were necessary, of course, a new way of preparing for a winter that seemed far away, but would arrive like an unwanted guest on the worst possible day. More importantly, it kept Vianne's mind occupied. When she was working in her garden, or boiling strawberries for preserves, or pickling cucumbers, she wasn't thinking of Antoine and how long it had been since she'd heard from him. It was the uncertainty that gnawed at her. Was he a prisoner of war? Was he wounded somewhere? Dead? Or would she look up one day and see him walking up this road, smiling? Missing him, longing for him, worrying about him. Those were her nighttime journeys. In a world now laden with bad news and silence, the one bit of good news was that Captain Beck had spent much of the summer away on one campaign or another. In his absence, the household settled into a routine of sorts. Isabel did all that was asked of her without complaint. It was October now, and chilly. Vianne found herself distracted as she walked home from school with Sophie. She could feel that one of her heels was coming loose, and it made her slightly unsteady. Her black kidskin Oxfords weren't made for the kind of everyday use to which they'd been put in the past few months. The sole was beginning to pull away at the toe, which often caused her to trip. The worry about replacing things like shoes was never far away. A ration card did not mean there were shoes or food to be bought. Vian kept one hand on Sophie's shoulder, both to steady her gait and to keep her daughter close. There were Nazi soldiers everywhere, riding in lorries and on motorcycles with machine gun-mounted sidecars. They marched in the square, their voices raised in triumphant song. A military lorry honked at them, and they moved farther onto the sidewalk as a convoy rumbled past. More Nazis.
"Is that Tante Isabel?" Sophie asked.
Vian glanced in the direction of Sophie's finger. Sure enough, Isabel was coming out of an alley, clutching her basket. She looked furtive, was the only word that came to mind. Furtive. At that, a dozen little pieces clicked into place. Tiny incongruities became a pattern. Isabel had often left Le Jardin in the wee hours of the morning, much earlier than necessary. She had dozens of long-winded excuses for absences that Vian had barely cared about. Heels that broke, hats that flew off in the wind and had to be chased down, a dog that frightened her and blocked her way. Was she sneaking out to be with a boy?
"Tante Isabel!"
Sophie cried out. Without waiting for a reply or permission, Sophie darted into the street. She dodged a trio of German soldiers who were tossing a ball back and forth.
"Merde!"
Vian muttered.
"Pardon,"
she said, ducking around the soldiers and striding across the cobblestone street.
"What did you get today?"
she heard Sophie ask Isabel as her daughter reached into the willow basket. Isabel slapped Sophie's hand, hard. Sophie yelped and drew her hand back.
"Isabel!"
Vian said harshly.
"What's wrong with you?"
Isabel had the good grace to blush.
"I am sorry. It's just that I'm tired. I have been in queues all day. And for what? A veal jelly bone with barely any meat on it and a tin of milk. It's disheartening. Still, I shouldn't be rude. I'm sorry, Soph."
"Perhaps if you didn't sneak out so early in the morning, you wouldn't be tired," Vian said.
"I'm not sneaking out," Isabel said. "I'm going to the shops for food. I thought you wanted that of me. And by the way, we need a bicycle. These walks to town on bad shoes are killing me."
Vian wished she knew her sister well enough to read the look in her eyes. Was it guilt? Or worry? Or defiance? If she didn't know better, she'd say it was pride. Sophie linked arms with Isabel as the three of them set off for home. Vian studiously ignored the changes to Karivo, the Nazis taking up so much space, the posters on the limestone walls. The new anti-Jewish tracts were sickening, and the red and black swastika flags hanging above doorways and from balconies. People had begun to leave Karivo, abandoning their homes to the Germans. The rumor was that they were going to the free zone, but no one knew for sure. Shops closed and didn't reopen. She heard footsteps coming up behind her and said evenly,
"Let's walk faster."
"Madame Mauriac, if I may interrupt."
"Good Lord, is he following you?"
Isabel muttered. Vian slowly turned around.
"Herr Captain," she said.
People in the street watched Vian closely, eyes narrowed in disapproval.
"I wanted to say that I will be late tonight and will, sorrowfully, not be there for supper," Beck said.
"How terrible,"
Isabel said in a voice as sweet and bitter as burnt caramel. Vian tried to smile, but really, she didn't know why he'd stopped her.
"I will save you something."
"Nein, you are most kind."
He fell silent. Vian did the same. Finally, Isabel sighed heavily.
"We are on our way home, Herr Captain."
"Is there something I can do for you, Herr Captain?" said Vian.
Beck moved closer.
"I know how worried you have been about your husband, so I did some checking."
"Oh,
It is not fine news. I am sorrowful to report. Your husband, Antoine Moyag, has been captured along with many of your townsmen. He is in a prisoner of war camp. He handed her a list of names and a stack of official postcards. He will not be coming home.
Vianne barely remembered leaving town. She knew Isabel was beside her, holding her upright, urging her to put one foot in front of the other, and that Sophie was beside her, chirping out questions as sharp as fish hooks.
What is a prisoner of war? What did Herr Captain mean that Papa would not be coming home? Never?
Vianne knew when they'd arrived home because the scents of her garden greeted her, welcomed her. She blinked, feeling a little like someone who had just wakened from a coma to find the world impossibly changed.
Sophie, Isabel said firmly, go make your mother a cup of coffee. Open a tin of milk. But...
Go, Isabel said. When Sophie was gone, Isabel turned to Vianne, cupped her face with cold hands.
He'll be all right.
Vianne felt as if she were breaking apart, bit by bit, losing blood and bone as she stood here, contemplating something she had studiously avoided thinking about. A life without him. She started to shiver. Her teeth chattered.
Come inside for coffee, Isabel said.
Into the house? Their house? His ghost would be everywhere in there. A dent in the divan where he sat to read. The hook that held his coat. And the bed. She shook her head, wishing she could cry, but there were no tears in her. This news had emptied her. She couldn't even breathe. Suddenly, all she could think about was the sweater of his that she was wearing. She started to strip out of her clothes, tearing off the coat and the vest, ignoring Isabel shouted, No! As she yanked the sweater over her head and buried her face in the soft wool, trying to smell him in the yarn, his favorite soap, him. But there was nothing but her own smell. She lowered the bunched-up sweater from her face and stared down at it, trying to remember the last time he'd worn it. She picked at a loose thread, and it unraveled in her hand, became a squiggly coil of wine-colored yarn. She bit it off and tied a knot to save the rest of the sleeve. Yarn was precious these days. These days. When the world was at war, and everything was scarce, and your husband was gone.
I don't know how to be on my own.
What do you mean? We were on our own for years. From the moment Maman died.
Vianne blinked. Her sister's words sounded a little jumbled, as if they were running on the wrong speed.
You were alone, she said.
I never was. I met Antoine when I was 14, and got pregnant at 16, and married him when I was barely 17. Papa gave me this house to get rid of me. So you see, I've never been on my own. That's why you're so strong, and I'm... not.
You will have to be, Isabel said. For Sophie.
Vianne drew in a breath. And there it was. The reason she couldn't eat a bowl of arsenic or throw herself in front of a train. She took the short coil of crooked yarn and tied it to an apple tree branch. The burgundy color stood out against the green and brown. Now, each day in her garden, and when she walked to her gate, and when she picked apples, she would pass this branch and see this bit of yarn and think of Antoine. Each time she would pray, to him and to God, come home.
Come,
Isabel said, putting an arm around Vianne, pulling her close. Inside, the house echoed the voice of a man who wasn't there. Vianne stood outside Rachel's stone cottage. Overhead, the sky was the color of smoke on this cold, late afternoon. The leaves of the trees, marigold and tangerine and scarlet, were just beginning to darken around the edges. Soon they would drop to the ground. Vianne stared at the door, wishing she didn't need to be here. but she had read the names Beck had given her. Mark de Champlain was also listed. When she finally found the courage to knock, Rachel answered almost instantly, wearing an old house dress and sagging woolen stockings. A cardigan sweater hung askew, buttoned incorrectly. It gave her an odd, tilted look.
"Viens, come in. Sarah and I were just making a rice pudding. It's mostly water and gelatin, of course, but I used a bit of milk."
Viens managed a smile. She let her friend sweep her into the kitchen and pour her a cup of the bitter ersatz coffee. That was all they could get. Viens was remarking on the rice pudding. What she even said, she didn't know. When Rachel turned and asked,
"What's wrong?"
Viens stared at her friend. She wanted to be the strong one, for once, but she couldn't stop the tears that filled her eyes.
"Stay in the kitchen," Rachel said to Sarah. "If you hear your brother wake up, get him."
"You," she said to Viens,
"come with me."
She took Viens by the arm and guided her through the small salon and into Rachel's bedroom. Viens sat on the bed and looked up at her friend. Silently, she held out the list of names she'd gotten from Beck.
"They're prisoners of war, Rachel. Antoine and Mark and all the others. They won't be coming home."
3 days later, on a frosty Saturday morning, Viens stood in her classroom and stared out at the group of women seated in desks that were too small for them. They looked tired and a little wary. No one felt comfortable gathering these days. It was never clear exactly how far verboten extended into conversations about the war, and besides that, the women of Karivaux were exhausted. They spent their days standing in line for insufficient quantities of foods, and when they weren't in line, they were foraging the countryside or trying to sell their dancing shoes or a silk scarf for enough money to buy a loaf of good bread. In the back of the room, tucked into the corner, Sophie and Sarah were leaning against each other, knees drawn up, reading books. Rachel moved her sleeping son from one shoulder to the other and closed the door of the classroom.
"Thank you all for coming. I know how difficult it is these days to do anything more than the absolutely necessary."
There was a murmuring of agreement among the women.
"Why are we here?" Madame Fournier asked tiredly.
Viens stepped forward. She had never felt completely comfortable around some of the women, many of whom had disliked Viens when she moved here at 14. When Viens had caught Antoine, the best-looking young man in town, they'd liked her even less. Those days were long past, of course, and now Viens was friendly with these women and taught their children and frequented their shops. But even so, the pains of adolescence left a residue of discomfort.
"I have received a list of French prisoners of war from Karivaux. I am sorry, terribly sorry, to tell you that your husband's, and mine and Rachel's, are on the list. I am told they will not be coming home."
She paused, allowing the women to react. Grief and loss transformed the faces around her. Viens knew the pain mirrored her own. Even so, it was difficult to watch, and she found her eyes misting again. Rachel stepped close, took her hand.
"I got us postcards," Viens said. "Official ones, so we can write to our men."
"How did you get so many postcards?"
Madame Fournier asked, wiping her eyes.
"She asked her German for a favor," said Hélène Rouel,
the baker's wife.
"I did not, and he's not my German," Viens said. "He's a soldier who has requisitioned my home. Should I just let the Germans have Le Jardin? Just walk away and have nothing? Every house or hotel in town with a spare room has been taken by them. I am not special in this."
More tisking and murmurs. Some women nodded, others shook their heads.
"I would have killed myself before I let one of them move into my house," Hélène said.
"Would you, Hélène? Would you really?" Viens said. "And would you kill your children first or throw them into the street to survive on their own?"
Hélène looked away.
They have taken over my hotel, a woman said. And they are gentlemen for the most part. A bit crude, perhaps. Wasteful.
Gentlemen, Hélène spat the word. We are pigs to the slaughter. You will see, pigs who put up no fight at all.
I haven't seen you at my butcher shop recently, Madame Fournier said to Vianne in a judgmental voice.
My sister goes for me, Vianne said. She knew this was the point of their disapproval. They were afraid that Vianne would get, and take, special privileges that they would be denied.
I would not take food or anything from the enemy.
She felt suddenly as if she were back in school, being bullied by the popular girls.
Vianne is trying to help,
Rachel said sternly enough to shut them up. She took the postcards from Vianne and began handing them out. Vianne took a seat and stared down at her own blank postcard. She heard the chicken scratching of other pencils on other postcards, and slowly she began to write.
My beloved Antoine, we are well. Sophie is thriving, and even with so many chores, we found some time this summer to spend by the river. I think of you with every breath and pray you are well. Do not worry about us and come home. Je t'aime, Antoine.
Her lettering was so small she wondered if he would even be able to read it, or if he would get it, or if he was alive. For God's sake, she was crying. Rachel moved in beside her, laid a hand on her shoulder.
We all feel it, she said quietly.
Moments later, the women rose one by one. Wordlessly, they shuffled forward and gave Vianne their postcards.
Don't let them hurt your feelings, Rachel said. They're just scared.
I'm scared too, Vianne said.
Rachel pressed her postcard to her chest. Her fingers splayed across the small square of paper, as if she needed to touch each corner.
How can we not be?
Afterward, when they returned to Le Jardin, Beck's motorcycle with the machine gun-mounted sidecar was parked in the grass outside the gate. Rachel turned to her.
Do you want us to come in with you?
Vianne appreciated the worry in Rachel's gaze, and she knew that if she asked for help, she would get it. But how was she to be helped?
No, merci, we are fine. He has probably forgotten something and will soon leave again. He is rarely here these days.
Where is Isabel?
A good question. She sneaks out every Friday morning before the sunrise.
She leaned closer, whispered.
I think she is meeting a boy.
Good for her.
To that, Vianne had no answer.
Will he mail the postcards for us? Rachel asked.
I hope so.
Vianne stared at her friend a moment longer. Then she said, Well, we will know soon enough, and led Sophie into the house. Once inside, she instructed Sophie to go upstairs to read. Her daughter was used to such directives, and she didn't mind. Vianne tried to keep her daughter and Beck separated as much as possible. He was seated at the dining room table with papers spread out in front of him. At her entrance, he looked up. A drop of ink fell from the tip of his fountain pen, landed in a blue starburst on the white sheet of paper in front of him.
Madame, most excellent. I am pleased you are returned.
She moved forward cautiously, holding the packet of postcards tightly. They'd been tied up with a scrap of twine.
I have some postcards here, written by friends in town, to our husbands, but we don't know where to send them. I hoped perhaps you could help us.
She shifted uncomfortably from one foot to the other, feeling acutely vulnerable.
Of course, madame. I would be pleased to do this favor for you, although it will take much time and research to accomplish.
He rose politely.
As it happens, I am now concocting a list for my superiors at the Commandanture. They need to know the names of some of the teachers at your school.
Oh,
she said, uncertain as to why he would tell her this. He never spoke of his work. Of course, they didn't speak often about anything.
Jews, communists, homosexuals, Freemasons, Jehovah's Witnesses. Do you know these people?
I am Catholic, Herr Captain, as you know. We do not speak of such things at school. I hardly know who are homosexuals and Freemasons at any rate.
Ah, so you know the others.
I don't understand.
I am unclear. My pardons. I would appreciate it most sternly if you would let me know the names of the teachers in your school who are Jewish or communist.
Why do you need their names?
It is clerical, merely. You know us Germans. We are list makers.
He smiled and pulled a chair out for her. Vianne stared down at the blank paper on the table, then at the postcards in her hand. If Antoine received one, he might write back. She might know at last if he was alive.
This is not secret information, Herr Captain. Anyone can give you these names.
He moved in close to her.
With some effort, madam, I believe I can find your husband's address and mail a package for you also. Would this be sanguine?
Sanguine is not the right word, Herr Captain. You mean to ask me if it would be all right?
She was stalling, and she knew it. Worse, she was pretty sure that he knew it.
Ah, thank you so much for tutoring me in your beautiful language. My apologies.
He offered her a pen.
Do not worry, madame. It is clerical, merely.
Vianne wanted to say that she wouldn't write down any names. But what would be the point? It was easy enough for him to get this information in town. Everyone knew whose names belonged on the list, and Beck could throw her out of her own house for such a defiance. And what would she do then? She sat down and picked up the pen and began to write down names. It wasn't until the end of the list that she paused and lifted the pen tip from the paper.
I'm done,
she said in a soft voice.
You have forgotten your friend.
Did I?
Surely you meant to be accurate.
She bit her lip nervously and looked down at the list of names. She was certain suddenly that she shouldn't have done this. But what choice did she have? He was in control of her home. What would happen if she defied him? Slowly, feeling sick to her stomach, she wrote the last name on the list. Rachel de Champlain,